Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and this edition of What Fresh Hell. We welcome you. It is March 18th, and it is a delight to have you all here. Thank you very much for being here. I will tell you that it's the 18th of March, and it's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Last night, I was at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts. We had a lovely St. Patrick's Day event with writer Emma O'Donohue, and it was just amazing, absolutely amazing, wonderful writer. And Joan Grenier, who is the owner of the Odyssey, will be with us later for book picks this week. So that was a terrific event, and so saw a lot of people from the Pioneer Valley out last night who were out to see us, and it was really, really a wonderful, wonderful event. Came home, did stories for today, and then everything changed. So we'll sort of go through what's happening today, and there's certainly a lot to try to keep track of, and we will do exactly that on this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce this fine group for you this morning. We welcome former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain to the program. Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
How did you celebrate?
Well, it was low key. it was over the weekend was a little easier. You know,
yes.
I attended a party that a friend had that lots and lots of traditional Irish food, corned beef and cabbage.
Very nice.
And all that.
Shepherd's pie and the like.
Yeah, and soda bread, all that.
Oh, isn't that good?
Yeah,
oh,
it was great.
I love
yeah.
the soda bread. Mm. And tomorrow, St. Joseph's Day.
I know. That's today is like somebody born today is in between two of the greatest feasts.
Yes, that's very true. Absolutely true. Speaking of the Irish, Kathy Sheehan is here. Hello, Mayor Sheehan. How are you?
I'm good. And speaking of someone born today, my beautiful, wonderful granddaughter, Athena, was born today. And she is three. And so I want to wish her a happy birthday. I believe she's listening as she's getting ready for school this morning.
Very good.
So get dressed. Go to school. Love you.
Let's make it Athena's feast day. That'd be great. Yeah. Sounds wonderful. Wonderful to have you here, Mayor. Thank you very much. Jay Jochnowitz joins us. He is with the Times Union, where he is a semi-retired gentleman who does all of these things. Editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well. I'm getting over the trauma of not being able to find corned beef yesterday. This is what happens when you do things at the last minute. There was not a corned beef in three supermarkets that I went to.
No,
two Price Choppers, including the butcher at the first Price Chopper I went to, said, don't go to the second one because he came here to raid my corned beefs. So I learned how to make Irish stew last night.
Oh, there great. You go.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's
good.
Good. Yeah,
the
branch out, sure. That's fine. Okay, let's get started. First of all, Israel has carried out deadly strikes in Gaza and warns of intensified attacks. This is the sobering and horrific news that hundreds are killed. Gazan officials say shattering a period of relative calm. As talks with Hamas stall, Israel puts war back on the table. The strikes raise concerns about the hostages, fewer than half of whom are thought to be alive. This is the latest. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said Israel would use increasing military strength against Hamas after talks with the group reached an impasse. The aerial assault, the first major strikes in Gaza since the truce began in January, killed hundreds of Gazan, killed hundreds, according to Gazan health officials. And those words from Netanyahu's office released just a few minutes ago. Israeli forces launched large aerial attacks across the Gaza Strip in the first major strikes on the territory. Gaza's health ministry said more than 400 people had been killed in the attacks, which raised the prospect of a return to all-out war. The attacks followed weeks of fruitless negotiations aimed at extending the fragile ceasefire, which began in mid-January and paused for 15 months of devastating fighting in the territory. By midday Tuesday, it remained unclear whether the strikes were a brief attempt to force Hamas to compromise in the talks or the beginning of a new phase in the conflict. But again, Prime Minister Netanyahu saying that they would use increasing military strength in his statement just moments ago. Mike?
Yeah, I certainly hope it's a just pressure to get the negotiations going again, although I'm rather skeptical of that. When 400 people reportedly, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, are dead as a result of what sounds like quite an attack, it sounds like it's back on again. It sounds like the ceasefire is over, and I hope and pray that that's not true, because it's a ghastly thing. It went on for 15 months. People, you can argue about how many people died and how many people kicked out of their homeland because of it. But it's just horrific. And every bit of pressure the United States and influence the United States has on Israel and in this process, this negotiating process, needs to be turned to that, and so this can stop and negotiations begin again.
Is it cynical to ask of what exactly this administration can and would be to do?
I mean, certainly. I'm not going to suggest that even the Trump administration, who maybe I disagree with on a lot of things, doesn't want to see this war over. It's just, and frankly, he may not have any kind of influence that could just halt it. But boy, it has to be, the pressure has to be on. I mean, this is a number one priority to reestablish a ceasefire and let negotiations and humanitarian aid. I mean, this is going to interrupt humanitarian aid that's been flowing into Gaza since January, when the ceasefire began, and that has an enormous human toll, as documented, and it needs to be a top priority. I can't understand why even the Trump administration wouldn't be doing everything they can to stop this.
The United States bears full responsibility for the massacres of Palestinians in Gaza on Tuesday, Hamas said in a statement, after White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said that Israel consulted Washington ahead of the extensive strikes. Mayor Sheehan.
Well, certainly we continue to see, I think, a waging of a war that even those who support Israel have deep concerns about. And there has not been strong support for Netanyahu at all that I have seen. And the fact that Israel invests what it does in its military and in its intelligence, and rather than targeted attacks, we continue to see this sort of what appears to us as indiscriminate destruction and death is heartbreaking. I attended a summit on anti-Semitism that was held for mayors back in December, and we watched a film that was horrific to watch. It was a film that showed actual live stream and GoPro camera footage of the terrorist attack that occurred, and it particularly focused on the impact on children, including those who lost their lives, those who watched parents executed. And it was horrific. And I also know that from those who are living in Gaza, the same lived experience could be told of the horrors that are being wrought upon the children of Gaza and families in Gaza and people who are just trying to survive. And so when we look at what happened today, I think for those, or yesterday, for those who want peace and want to find a way towards peace, this continues to divide us, and it's going to continue, I think, to spur the type of vitriol and anger that is understandable, but that does not lead to a productive solution. And one stepping back and looking at that says maybe that's not what the leaders in Israel want. And certainly those could question whether the leaders of Hamas want peace as well.
Carolyn Leavitt said, as President Trump has made clear, Hamas, the Houthis, and Iran, all those who seek to terrorize not just Israel, but also the United States of America, will see a price to pay. All hell will break loose. Jay.
Yeah, I thought the whole ceasefire thing was kind of weird, to be honest. That how you have negotiations when... I should preface this by saying I agree that Hamas should cease to exist. But how you have negotiations with someone when they want you to cease to exist, I don't know how you have honest negotiations like that. Israel wants to destroy Hamas. This was a pause. It was a humanitarian pause. There was some pressure in the world. But I think either Mike or Joe, you said one thing about how you can't see how the United States doesn't want this to end. I don't think it does. I don't, you know, this is, we have a president who has stated outright he wants Gaza cleared out so it can be turned into a resort. I take him absolutely at his word on this. I think this is, I don't think Donald Trump was playing games. I don't think he was being silly. I don't think he was trying to distract. I think he really does think that there's some prime land, beachfront land there, and that somehow in its benevolence, the United States could develop that land and make a happy life for Palestinians and all people. And so we have this ceasefire briefly, and Israel steps back in when it's ready. And resumes the fight. I'm not at all surprised. I'm surprised it lasted as long as it did.
The only thing that I would react to there is I don't think there's any benevolence. He wants the Palestinians out, and you're presuming he would let them come back in once he's built his multi-million dollar resort in Gaza.
I should have rolled my eyes a little
harder. So I just wanted to make sure that I was that the viewers or that the listeners could sense the sarcasm.
Fair enough.
But you know, I think it's sort of like tariffs, right? People
I thought it was just implied.
Yeah.
To you.
people thought that that he didn't really mean it, but he did. And when he says these things, I think you're absolutely right. He means it.
Yep.
Yeah,
it's
also looks like it's the proxy war with Iran, where he has, you know, already established. He, you know, in the first Trump administration, he was almost launching missiles at Iran and was kind of pulled back by his advisors. Those advisors no longer are there, and the people that are there are probably right on the same page as Trump. I mean, we could end up, this could escalate into a full Mideast war, and the United States could be heavily involved in it. And that's the reason tactically that we have to do everything we can and use every bit of pressure we have. And I don't think anybody disagrees to de-escalate the situation right now. But it does sadly feel like the war's back on.
I think so. And the other part of that, the other kind of self-serving part of perpetuating this from the Trump administration's perspective is it's done it predates the Trump 2.0. Republicans in Congress are already doing this. They were using anti-Semitism and anti-Netanyahu sentiment, anti-war sentiment, as an excuse to turn that into anti-Semitism, and to go after colleges and universities, which they consider to be bastions of liberal thought, and the attack on Columbia that we're watching, withdrawal of $400 million in funds. What a blow to a university that is! And
significant.
So I don't see a downside for the Trump administration in saying keep it going as long as we can. We'll milk this for all it's worth.
And the irony, or not even irony, but that completely consistent with what you're suggesting is that. This is going to provoke protests in the U.S. that are going to be pro-Palestinian, and they are going to be turned right into, equivalent to pro-Hamas, which there are differences, as we know. And it, anybody who holds a green card, who even shows up at one of these rallies, will be thrown on a plane and kicked out of the country.
Sorry.
I mean, this is the process that we'll talk about it in a broader sense, I'm sure, today. But it's become the new method of the operation. You know, just scare anybody who dares to speak against the United States government, and it's going to become a tool in that effort.
And they have ratcheted that rhetoric up by saying that this speech is illegal.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
That's going to, I think, in this renewed, I think you're absolutely right, in this renewed atmosphere of war, the protests are going to be cracked down on much harder by this administration.
Well, and then the universities themselves of having to deal with it, and what's at stake for them. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a great group here. Mike Spain, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and Jay Jochnowitz. And we'll come back. We'll continue this conversation. We'll move on to your letters as well. And then much more to discuss as the morning progresses. Again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. First, some messages and then news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are talking about the latest attacks in the Middle East, and we have letters a lot about, it seems to be about the use of the word war, the first couple anyway. Norma says, "This is not a war, it is a genocide using American arms and American taxpayer funds. How can America say they are not responsible for all the death and destruction when they are paying for it?" That goes into Roy's letter. "It's not a war. Everyone with half a brain and any morals around the world knows that it is a genocide. It's not a war. I know that NPR doesn't want anyone to use the word, but that's exactly what it has been, and we are just sitting around talking about it while Israel and Trump just keep doing what they want to do, just like Biden before this."
That is what governments do, unfortunately. They do what they want to do, and there is nothing really to stop this situation. World condemnation isn't going to move Netanyahu as long as Trump stands behind him, as long as the United States stands behind him. And they're going to do what they're going to do what they want to do. It was an odd headline, though, in the Times when I looked at it, that it imperiled the ceasefire. I think the ceasefire is over. It was just an odd way of putting it.
I thought so. Yeah.
I kind of a change of topic from what the letter writer was saying. The word genocide is so, I don't disagree with it in this case. I think they are trying to, if it's not genocide, it certainly is ethnic cleansing, removing people from an area that is their home.
Falls under the same definition.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's fraught, right? Because
right,
Hamas
exactly.
has genocidal intentions towards the Jews.
Right.
And so
absolutely.
I think that one of the things that I find so frustrating is when we were talking about this on the break is that, you know, Columbia University and other schools during the height of the protests sent emails to Jewish students saying, "Go home. You can finish your coursework from home because we can't keep you safe." And if that had happened to any other group, if they had said to all women on campus, "We can't keep you safe," or all people of color, "We can't keep you safe," I think there would have been significant outrage and consternation. And yet it happened, and that is the reason why this $400 million, among other things, is being withheld from Columbia. And at the very time that more than ever that we need, dare I say, diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, to take the opportunity to lower the temperature and have these really important conversations about the impacts of what is happening, about the history of it, about how we build bridges and how we build understandings among people. The very time that we need that more than ever, we're being told that, you know, that is just being way too woke. And so it's for me, this huge lost opportunity, but it's incredibly intentional on the part of this administration. I don't think they want us to have these conversations. I don't think they want us to find bridges to peace. And so we're going to continue to have these conversations over and over again. What did you call the show today? Are you going to rebrand it?
Yeah. What fresh hell?
What fresh hell?
Every time my wife says, she starts something when I come in the room with, did you hear? And I said, oh, God, what fresh hell?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the show is 25 years old this year, and if we were starting it up today, I think that would be the title.
Instead of Fresh Air.
Welcome to Fresh Hell. That's a great point, Mike. Yeah. I think, yeah, and that should be more accurate, too. Barry says Donald Trump cares about nothing and no one beyond his own skin. To say that he wants the strife in the Mideast to end because of human suffering is one of the most naive statements I've heard in a long time. Unless there's money to be made or power to be grabbed at any cost, no issue is even on his radar. On a related topic, I'd love to hear the panel's thoughts on the deletion of records at Arlington National Cemetery of Blacks, Women, Indigenous People, like the Code Talkers who helped to win World War II, and others who aren't white, including those at Iwo Jima, I would mention. Yeah. My take to say this is insane and despicable is the understatement of the century, and that, of course, goes with the a different purge, but with the Enola Gay scrubbing as well.
Yeah, and the Pentagon has also cleansed its website of, you know, tributes to Navajo Code Talkers who got us, you know, gave us a great advantage in World War I and again in World War II. And, you know, just several different groups and even just, you know, women, you know, blacks, Tuskegee Airmen, you know, all have been kind of removed from places of prominence on these national websites. And in what the listener just described it, I mean, it's just terrific. And but, you know, the escalation of the war going on in Gaza, the whether it's the DEI, the issues over the, you know, taking immigrants to El Salvador, and we'll talk about that. All of these are wedge issues, and they become very, very useful to Trump to get people to be divided. We're not interested in talking about ways to, you know, show accountability and somehow bridge the gaps that are between people. There's no intention, no effort whatsoever of bridging the gaps between people in the U.S. today. It's too useful to have them divided and angry than it is to try to bring people together. You know, and you can argue about the way it all turned out till the cows come home, but when Biden took over in 2021, that was one of his pledges, that he would try to bring people together and unite people. And it was extraordinarily difficult. I mean, the factions that are fueled by just hateful rhetoric that comes out of the Trump people, the MAGA people, it's like pouring gasoline on smoldering coals and all of a sudden explodes. And then you say, ah, look at that. And we got to do something about that. I mean, it's the wedge issue thing. I mean,
Well, there's a purpose to it.
Yes.
The idea that, you know, I remember seeing, I can't remember the name of the movie, but it was about the Code Talkers. Maybe it was called Code Talkers. And I remember coming away from that feeling really good. It was like, wow, this is something I did not know about before. And when you experience that, you have a different perspective on people going forward. So you become perhaps more sympathetic to what we've done to Native Americans and what we still do to Native Americans, in a sense, and the enduring legacy of that. And if you scrub
the history that breeds familiarity with people and understanding of people and sympathy towards people, you eradicate the sympathy today for the injustices that people want to perpetuate. And that's the real crime that's going on. I don't know that Donald Trump thinks that through as, you know, he doesn't think it through that much, but I think other people do.
Well, certainly those who are trying to continue to drive this wedge are very calculated about it. And I think that the sad thing about it is that the heroism and the contribution of the code talkers doesn't make what my uncles did fighting for our country during World War II any less heroic.
Not a bit.
Not a bit. And that is what we are seeing, is that we are seeing the diminishment of contributions that allowed us to come together as a nation and do something that saved democracy from fascism. And that is being turned into a wedge issue, that if we talk about all, that somehow we're diminishing the contributions of the many, mostly white men, but not all, who went and fought valiantly and were heroes. And that is what we are being driven into a division about. And neither of my uncles are alive to say, to weigh in on that. But I don't think that they viewed it as a zero-sum game. I think they knew and they were grateful for the entire war effort that occurred and all of us coming together at that time. And that was, you know, now that is becoming, again, I'm just way too woke.
Any mention, this is one example, but Colin Powell, any mention of him being African American, being black, has been scrubbed from the page. There is no, there was a profile on him of black and female veterans. That's gone. I just don't. I mean, at one turn, it seems really silly, and then petty, and then just chilling.
Both, yeah. At the same time.
Think about the process that went into that. I mean, it's right out of 1984. It's you must have this rather large number of people working, sitting at terminals every day, looking at, you know, the proverbial piece of paper that has Goldstein on it, shaking the leader's hand, and saying, "Oh, we got to get rid of that," and down the memory hole it goes, or off the screen it goes.
I was curious as to if the families have anything involved in this of being honored, of what is portrayed on the
monuments,
on the monuments, and in the materials that are provided by Arlington National Cemetery. It's
I think that Trump has a particular bone to pick with Arlington, because during the campaign last year he had what amounted to a political rally in a sacred area where that was, that kind of activity was barred, and his people were called on it, and they did what they do so well, is they pretty much ignored it and blamed the other side for being overreacting and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, he was embarrassed by Arlington, and they're going, you know, this is a presidency of retribution and revenge. And he said it would be, as Jay were pointing, I take him for what he says. Yeah, I will be your retribution. Well, he's his retribution right now.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Meanwhile, in other news, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, is escalating the fight with federal courts over deportation authority. We spoke of this yesterday, but we know more now than we did then. Not a lot more, but here we go. Several legal experts said the deportation episode marks a dramatic and troubling escalation in the Trump administration's pushback against the courts. The Trump administration's battle with the federal court system escalated sharply yesterday with governmental lawyers calling for the removal of a judge who blocked the deportation of alleged Venezuelan gang members and refusing to answer some questions in court. The administration for weeks has questioned the authority of courts to constrain the president, harshly attacking judges who issue nationwide injunctions and finding ways to circumvent certain adverse rulings. Some legal experts describe the pushback as a breakdown in the fragile balance of powers between the branches of government, which includes lower courts making initial rulings about executive initiatives that can be appealed all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Other experts offered more modulated assessments of the Trump administration's aggressive legal posture while acknowledging the judicial system was being put under intense strain. I just also want to touch, that was from the Washington Post, I do want to touch on the New York Times coverage of this story as they did a review of flight data showing that at the time of a federal judge's order, two flights were in the air and one had not yet taken off. This is important because the ruling was clear. The Trump administration could not use an obscure wartime law from the 18th century to deport people without a hearing. If any planes were already in the air, the judge said, they should turn back. Well, that didn't happen. Instead, the Trump administration sent more than 200 migrants to El Salvador over the weekend, including alleged gang members on three planes. A New York Times review of the flight data showed that none of the planes in question landed in El Salvador before the judge's order, and that one of them did not even leave American soil until after the judge's written order was posted online. Jay, I know you editorialized on this in the paper. What do you make of it?
It's, you know, there's so many, you know, when you step back, there's so many false premises here that the Trump administration puts in front of the American people when it talks about this. You know, probably the biggest false premise is that the courts have no jurisdiction here. It is the most fundamental aspect of our democracy that we have three co-equal branches of government and that it's real simple. I remember this from elementary school. The legislature makes the laws, the executive executes the laws, and the courts interpret the laws. And this is and if you read the Constitution, it is so explicit. What the court's jurisdiction is are matters of interpreting the Constitution. That, you know, and you know, by extension, it becomes all the laws that come from that. It's so fundamental, and the administration is just playing this game of parsing its words by saying we will comply with all court orders, except these aren't legitimate court orders. These are right.
At the same time, too, they're also arguing, the planes are already taken off. They're over international waters or over Mexico, and you no longer had jurisdiction. You don't have jurisdiction, period. And there was some confusion. And then, that order was verbal and it wasn't completely established. You know, they'll take all of these. And then people in the White House, you know, the Stephen Miller types will say the court is interfering and blocking the executive branch. That's a violation of the Constitution, and saying completely without any foundation this kind of rhetoric. I mean, it's like the courts, we adhere to the courts, except when we don't agree with the courts. We then say they don't have jurisdiction. And then, you know, there is an appeals process.
Exactly.
This judge only asked for a 14-day hold on this stuff, and it would let it all play out. And, you know, I'm not so sure if it got to the Supreme Court what the Supreme Court would do, but it never even had a chance to go through the cycles. Instead, the other thing they did is they asked the circuit court to take this judge off the case. I mean, you know, it's we saw this all happen when Trump was fighting criminal charges back during the 2022 and right. 2023. I mean, it was, you know, get the judge off the case because he's biased or she's biased. That's not, you know, and some of it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And shockingly, the Supreme Court said that he had an enormous amount of immunity. But it went through the process, at least. Now they're saying whatever sticks, you know.
And I think, you know, breaking this down, right? Americans were not in danger from any of these individuals. They were in custody.
Right.
The judge didn't say you have to release them. The judge just said you can't put them on a plane and fly them to some other country that they're not even from. Right. So that's number one. Nobody was in danger. This was not a threat to any of us. All of these individuals were in custody. And the second part, which, you know, you have pointed out, is that it was so far-fetched that they reached out into the Wayback Machine and used a law that clearly doesn't apply. I mean, it says whenever there is a declared war, right, or a war is threatened against the territory of the United States by any foreign nation or government, right? So clearly this doesn't apply. And we have laws for a reason, and we have due process for a reason. And this is a president that has benefited from all of the due process that many of us think he wasn't due. Yeah.
Right.
But he got it. And so I think that is what, for me, you learn over and over and over again. Once the judge signs the injunction, you stop doing what you're doing and you appeal and you continue to fight. And that is the way that the law works. His lawyers know that. This doesn't even pass the laugh test. I know Joe questioned the laugh test. I said, we're all taught it in law school. We're all taught the laugh test. It might not be enshrined in the Constitution, but, you know, to be able to stand in front of a judge, this doesn't even pass the laugh test. To say this is the basis upon which I am eliminating all due process and putting these people on a plane, it doesn't pass the laugh test.
And yet it goes on.
And yet it goes on.
Yeah. And another element of this is that they're sending these people, as you pointed out, Mayor Sheehan, to Venezuela. They're sending them to a third party, to El Salvador, where they're going to be put into this giant prison with 40,000 people, where they'll probably be tortured, starved, treated terribly, because that's what Bukele, the president of El Salvador, has been doing. They've been rounding up anybody who might possibly have maybe been 16 years old or older when there was a gang around, and throwing them into jail. People like it because it's safer down there now. The streets are safer. But 2% of the country are being held against their will without any due process. So it's a convenient hellhole for Trump to pay $6 million to them to take these. And it does another thing, too. You know, this mass immigration deportation that he promised when he was running for president hasn't been really happening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not at much of an accelerated rate from norms anyway. So doing this so publicly, putting all these people without any due process, some of whom are probably gang members and probably some of whom are completely innocent, putting them on a plane and sending them off to some hellhole in El Salvador, in a prison, is good optics. It's good for sound bites. It's good for little clips on TV and on social media.
I mean, you talk about the sound bites, but the question from the media, the direct question from reporters to the President of the United States, I believe aboard Air Force One, was, did you violate the judge's order? And he said, I don't know about that. However, these were bad hombres.
Yeah, that's his answer. Yeah.
And it has not been established whether they are bad hombres.
Well, and again, right, they came for the unionists. I mean, we're talking about immigrants, and I think a lot of people have various feelings about that. But I have received horrific emails and sent to the mayor's account from people who suggest that we do the same thing with you fill in the blank. You know, and so people of color, people, what it is,
green card holders.
This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. Well, we asked that question in the editorial today. You know, it's a slippery slope argument, but it's a valid one here with the president who, you know, it just is, you know, a creature of talk radio that everyone is the enemy, everyone's a radical, everyone's this, everyone's that. You know, what are you, you know, who is next? What speech is next that's going to bother him? What tattoo is going to be an excuse to arrest someone on suspicion of gang activity? What, you know, what demonstration are you going to be at
start
that the
with
president
Pete Hicks
decides? Yeah. Exactly. The other thing, and I this is just one of those things in the whole story that just really has bothered me, is the idea that on top of all the other legal nonsense that they are, somebody said spaghetti. It really is the spaghetti approach. Just see what sticks when you throw it against the wall. That they're now making an argument that they didn't make an argument, and they didn't make this particular argument in court. So the judge can't. So the judge's ruling is invalid because they had other arguments that they could have made, and they haven't had a chance to make them yet.
That is obtuse.
That's sort of what you do at way into the appeals level, maybe, if they say we're going to look at new issues. But I think you're a lawyer; you would know. You get to do that?
That's when attorneys break it down and say, "Wow, you really didn't think this through. This is an example of bad practice of law.
Yeah.
You don't get to say, oh, I forgot to raise this. As a matter of fact, there are many cases that we study in law school that the judges point out, had this argument been made, we may have come to a different conclusion. But you are now stopped from making that argument because you didn't make it in the original appeal.
Yeah,
that's the old Steve Martin routine.
I forgot.
I forgot it was illegal to shoot my mother-in-law in the face. I forgot. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us on this 18th day of March, 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. And we welcome you. Mayor Kathy Sheehan of the City of Albany joins us. We also are joined by former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, Editor-at-Large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, here as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. All right, couple letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. Roger says, Trump has done so many things illegal or unconstitutional. The Supreme Court gave almost total presidential immunity, and by the time such acts are, quote-unquote, resolved, they are moot points. We cannot wait until midterms to stop these many acts of madness, if not treason, and not in the long-term U.S. interests. Perhaps an unprecedented third impeachment is the only way to stop this near insanity. Otherwise, the path to tyranny and fascism may be unstoppable, and future elections will be a sham.
Well, that is fundamentally the point that we raised in the editorial today, that, you know, and this has long been understood in American history, that the judiciary doesn't have a police force, it doesn't have an army, it has no effective enforcement powers if the other branches don't go along with it. I guess they could get the U.S. Marshals out, but the U.S. Marshals answer to the president, the executive branch. So there's no enforcement mechanism here, and if the executive branch, if Donald Trump says, I am not going to obey these court orders, I'm sending those planes to El Salvador, and by gum, they are going there, there's nothing left other than Congress somehow interceding. And I think the only meaningful intercession is impeachment. And this Congress is not going to do it. And, you know, we were talking about this weekend before we actually met as an editorial board. I was talking to the editorial page editor. I said, you know, what are we going to write if we write about this? And she said, well, if nothing else, the futility of it all may be all we can say. And when we ended it, we did talk about the possibility that the inevitability that if anything is going to be done about this in the face of a lawless president, it is likely going to have to be impeachment. And this Congress is not going to do it unless there is a sea change in the base.
Which seems very...
So our democracy as we know it is over.
Well, that was where we left the editorial.
Yeah.
If we don't do this, that may well be where we are. And it's weird. Like, how you write that, and, you know, you write that for me, it was the safety of my home, you know, the quiet. And then I went out and played, you know, went over and petted the cat and played with the dog. And
It's like, and yet, I just wrote about the possible end of, you know, the Republic. This is weird. We are living through a really dangerous and
we're in the midst
time.
Of it right now. It isn't about to happen. It might not happen. It is happening, and it has to be arrested. And that's the reality.
Let me ask the journalists in the room, although please, Mayor, jump in as you see fit. But this, you know, the New York Times yesterday in their headline, you brought up one, Jay, but the other one about, you know, skirting a constitutional crisis. Who defines those rules of that game?
In terms of what the how you express that in a headline?
Well, no. I mean, how do you determine what a constitutional crisis is, and what is a constitutional? I mean, I guess is that in the eye of the beholder, or what is a constitutional crisis?
Oh, okay. What constitutes a constitutional crisis?
That's
is that
right.
What you're asking?
I mean, for me, it's like, oh, the president of the United States is going to host the Kennedy Center Honors. Well, that seems like a constitutional crisis, but I don't know. I think there's probably more to it than that.
I mean, I think in all seriousness, they've just defined it. You have a sitting president who ignores a court order, and there you have it. It happened.
And laws set by Congress.
It happened in the first however many, what day are we on? Right. I mean, I think we thought it would take longer to get here. I think people have always thought that the means of the constitutional crisis would be Trump ignoring the courts. And it has now happened. So, you know, to your point, Mike, this isn't something that's going to happen or that might happen. It happened yesterday.
So at what point then is it a constitutional crisis? And then What are the ramifications of that?
Right. So there. I think you're right that there is a bit of an eye of the beholder thing here.
Yes.
I think you know, even as the New York Times put it, that a lot of legal experts in the story said it's a constitutional crisis, but there's always one or two that are going to say, well, I don't know that we're quite at that, and the administration is going to say, well, the courts haven't run their course yet, but in the meantime, you are. This is like, I don't know why I always come back to John Gotti, but this is like, this would be John Gotti is sentenced for murder and he says, wait, I haven't done my appeals yet and I'm going to go, you can't arrest me. And you can't do this and you can't do that. And I don't have to honor the court decision until all these things are done. And, you know, of course, we all know you're supposed to, you know, you appeal. If you're lucky, the judge says, I'm going to issue a temporary restraining order or something like that. And you don't have to go to jail right away. You're free on bail until the court, that's resolved. But all that, there's a process to that. And if you have a mobster who just says, no, I'm going to make up my own process. And I'm going to do it the way I think, because I think I'm innocent until the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals in New York says that I'm absolutely guilty and have to go to jail. I don't have to go to jail. And that you don't get to make up the rules like that. And that's the constitutional crisis we're in. He's making up his own rules. He's deciding what the process is. And the thing he's got going for him is that he's the president of the United States and he does get to set this. Nobody's going to touch him.
Well, he has the Supreme Court ruling, right? That's one.
Right.
One thing that he has for him. And two, the American people don't really seem to care.
Half of them don't.
Well, so a majority that were able to reelect him following, let's just say, January 6th.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
And if you do the public opinion polls, people are favorable to his handling of immigration and border protection, if you ask it in that kind of a way. I mean, the trouble with those polls is it depends how you ask it and how you describe it and what it is that you're asking. But if you ask people generally, are you in favor or against Trump's, handling of the border? Oh, yeah, he's getting all the bad guys out of here. Yeah, I'm in favor of that. That's why we elected him. They don't get the people may not care that we're rounding up people without due process, that we're throwing people out of the country. We're throwing people behind bars without any legal authority to do so. And because it's all part of that show about getting rid of the bad hombres, as he likes to call them.
And as one person pointed out in this discussion, he really hasn't done that much in the way of mass deportation.
No.
Obama deported far more people than Trump did, far more people, I think, than Bush did before him. But the thing was, he did it without all this drama and theatrics. And he did it through due process, as far as I know. There may have been some glitches along the way where the courts said, but these weren't these all-or-nothing battles where the Constitution was at stake.
This is for optics, too, though. You got to remember.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Elizabeth Broughton said, our federal government no longer explicitly prohibits contractors from having segregated restaurants, waiting rooms, and drinking fountains. Now what? I'm appalled and sickened by this regime. I'll admit, I hadn't even heard of that, indeed, it was a change by the administration where segregated facilities are no longer banned in federal contracts. So the segregation clause is one of several identified in a public memo issued by the GSA, General Services Administration, affecting all civil federal agencies. The memo explains that it is making changes prompted by the executive order on diversity, equity, and inclusion, which repealed an executive order signed by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965 regarding federal contractors and non-discrimination. The memo also addresses Trump's executive order on gender identity.
So this, I missed the very beginning of this, I think. So this eliminates all bans on segregated facilities?
No. If a federal contractor is to qualify for a contract under the Lyndon Johnson executive order,
right,
they must be free of discrimination in their workplace, and okay, they must be able to defend that and demonstrate that. That no longer is required
okay
of federal contractors, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah.
Segregated facilities no longer explicitly banned in federal contracts. Take a moment, let that sink in. Okay. Oh.
But presumably that would still be a violation of the Civil Rights Act. So.
Oh, that's another issue, please.
But yeah, then we would need
enforcement.
Somebody to enforce it, which we've all been told is not going to happen anymore.
Mike,
at the federal level.
Mike writes, not our Mike, a different Mike. Mike writes, oh, Democrats, it's all about the optics. You really want the mass media reporting the Democrats are fighting to have Venezuelan drug gang members return to the United States? Most Americans just aren't educated enough to understand the complexities of what the Trump administration did. You need to focus on health care, Social Security, and kitchen table issues to win America back.
No, you need to ask the questions more appropriately, and you need to frame these things better. So, you know, Mike, the poll was a good example that, you know, do you approve of President Trump cracking down on immigration? That's an easy question to answer. Would you prefer that Donald Trump follow due process, follow the law in deporting immigrants, or would you prefer he break the law in deporting immigrants?
I wonder what that number would be.
And again, you know, I don't think this is about bringing people back. As I said, these people were in custody. They posed no danger to anyone. They were in custody. And so, yes, this is a simple question. Should the president have to listen to the judges, the federal judges? That's what the question is. And I think that is a kitchen table issue, although I do agree we need to be talking more about the impacts of the Republican spending plan and what it is going to do to families and working families, veterans, seniors, and their vision of, you know, this is a country for billionaires, but not the rest of us.
And the letter writer's not wrong. I mean, there's so much that could be talked about all those issues.
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, you talked about spaghetti against the wall. I mean, what it's effectively done is it's made it difficult to focus on one particular thing because there's five other things that are also going on simultaneously, right, and it's very difficult to follow that. It's difficult for the courts. It's difficult for human rights groups, the ACLU, to instantly respond to all of it, and that's part of a plan. This was very well implemented. This plan thought up by, you know, Stephen Miller and the gang, you know, before the election, was how to implement this and hit them hard before anything can be done to stop it. And then if we lose later, it doesn't matter. We made our impact, and that's what people wanted, you know.
Andre writes and said, I read recently that a more appropriate term would be constitutional rot. This recognizes that the erosion of its principles have been happening for a longer period of time. Gail says, we care, black people and people of color care about due process and what's happening in this country. We are going back to the 1619. Black people are targeted like no other people. Believe us when we tell you so, racism has never left this country. And that from Gail. John says, defending these accused criminals who are here illegally is a bad look for Democrats. You should be more circumspect about the battles you choose.
Oh, I think the country can chew gum, walk and chew gum at the same time. And if we let a president just be lawless on one front, he is going to be lawless on all sorts of other fronts.
But this is where Democrats fail, because we are allowing the Republicans to define what we're doing. We are not defending criminals who are here illegally committing crimes. Right. We are defending the fact that we have a judicial system and a constitution and a democracy that is under attack here. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about. And I agree. The Democrats are either talking in a way that opens us up to this attack, the very attack that this writer has pointed out, or we're attacking one another. And that's what I'm frustrated about. I'm really frustrated that we have not been able to seize back in any way, shape, or form the narrative about what's happening in this country. And we've got to get our stuff together and get serious about that. You know, I mean, people are furious at Senator Schumer when they need to be furious at the Republicans. You know, we need to get on the same talking points and talk about the impacts that this spending plan is having and is going to have on average working families. We need to talk about what happens in a country where a president doesn't listen to judges and what that means for the average American. That's what we need to be talking about.
We need to frame it. Yep. People need to frame this in a way that seizes back that narrative. You're absolutely right. And there is a wonderful, the Republicans have always been, in my lifetime, better at messaging than the Democrats. Not in my entire lifetime. I remember when I was young, it was very simple. In my household, the way my parents always expressed it was Republicans are the party of the rich. That's all you had to know as a working class kid, as a kid in a working class family.
Except it's not true.
No, it isn't. But it worked. It worked. It got me as a young person.
It's much less true now. I mean, if you look at the breakdown, so much of Trump's support comes from people who are so desperately reliant on the programs that they're destroying.
Yep.
And how do you get that message across? It's too much information. People don't want nuance. They don't want background. They just want sound bites.
Yep. But if you tell people who are poor or middle or lower middle class or even middle class and still struggling, if you tell them, that's because ultimately that Trump and Musk and the Republicans in Congress are doing all this to benefit the rich. Then you start creating a narrative that is
believable. I agree. I mean, I think that has legs. I mean, it's basically they're trying to make a case for giving a $4 trillion tax cut in the budget.
They are using you to benefit themselves.
Yeah.
And they are counting on your outrage over these wedge issues to allow them to take your money.
And my point wasn't the specifics of it. My point was the fact that the Republicans are just so much better at this branding because they simplify it. I said to my son years ago when I still could stomach listening to an entire evening of talk radio, of right-wing talk radio, that there is I can understand the comfort in it. Everything is black and white. It is so simple. And it doesn't matter from day to day what you said yesterday. As long as, you know, there are some truths that, quote-unquote truths, there are some consistencies that stay the same all through the narrative. We stand for the Constitution. They don't. You know, that kind of thing. They're radical. They hate the country. We don't. We love it. Those things are very simple and very comforting. And the Democrats have yet they like the complexity, and they get caught up in it.
We were talking about the scrubbing of the Arlington site, and Anna said, "Don't forget the 441st Battalion of Japanese Americans, whose website was taken down. They were put into some of the worst fighting, losing a huge number of their soldiers. Many of their families were simultaneously in concentration camps and also scrubbed from that story that is being told on the official website for Arlington." I do wonder if some of these organizations, like of Friends of the Library kind of thing, of whether those organizations that veterans organizations, other organizations that support Arlington are able to put that information up? I don't know. Yeah. All right. We'll take a break in just a second. I want to, with our time, we have about 15 minutes left after the break, and we'll get to a couple of more topics. One of them is about Senator Schumer, who postponed his book tour events amid the shutdown vote backlash and folks still calling for Chuck Schumer to resign his post and to leave his post as the minority leader. And that is seems to be, I don't know, I guess it seems to be growing and yet quiet at the moment, right?
Yeah, right. There was a visceral reaction to Schumer supporting the continuing resolution that the Republicans came up with because it didn't give the Democrats anything they wanted. There was no negotiation. And, you know, he made his case for it, and it's a palpable case that, you know, it just hands another tool to Trump to smash the Democrats and blame the shutdown of government on the Democrats. And you can go back and forth, and there's good arguments both ways, but it seems like that has only unleashed what has been frustration with Schumer's leadership, and some people are bouncing on it. But as you say, it's kind of quiet today.
So, a person that I go back and forth with occasionally, just because he's an interesting thinker, his name is Steve Villano. He used to work for Mario Cuomo, and he writes a Substack. And he, you know, I was going back and forth on this as well, that, you know, all right, so you don't want to give Trump the ability to, you know, do worse than he's already doing. I get Schumer's point. I get Gillibrand's point. But something seems missing here. And Steve hit the nail on the head in a Substack that he did. He said that they, even if they were going to do this, even if they were going to vote for the continuing resolution, that Schumer could have used the filibuster to let all the Democrats who objected to this and even the ones who were going to vote for it have their say. And you know, nothing like a shutdown to focus the nation's attention on Congress. They had the bully pulpit, finally. And they didn't use it. They could have used a filibuster for as long as they wanted to use it, right up until midnight on Friday, to do speeches, to say, here's what's wrong, look at what they're doing, to point out all the problems that are going on while the country was paying attention. And I said to Steve, you know, you didn't use the phrase in your Substack, but it was a failure of imagination on Schumer's part. He bought the binary choice.
We'll leave it there for just a moment. We'll take a break and be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to The World We Live In. The fourth most read political story in the Washington Post. Number four, White House says the U.S. won't return the Statue of Liberty to France. Okay.
What?
There we go. That is.
Did they want it back?
Yes. They want it back.
Well, we would send it back, but we'd slap a huge tariff on it.
That's a good, very, very good point. Very, very good. By the way, I won't be remiss here in mentioning who is responsible for the great music we've been hearing this morning. Christian McBride is an 8-time Grammy-winning bassist, composer, and bandleader. He's the artistic director of the historic Newport Jazz Festival, the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and the T.D. James Moody Jazz Festival, as well as the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. And Christian McBride and Ursa Major will be at the Assembly in Kingston tonight, and they will be at the Swire Theater at the Egg tomorrow night. You can find out more information at christianmcbride.com. christianmcbride.com. You can also see the playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable.
Okay. It felt like, you know, bourbon music.
Yeah, we had a bottle of bourbon in here yesterday. It was all wrapped up in plastic.
That.
Yeah, it was all wrapped up in plastic, and it was not opened at any time during the. We had a minor in the studio. It was, you know, we were all good people.
Joe, can I just add to what
Absolutely.
Jay said?
Absolutely, please
so,
do.
You know, I think that that's a good point about debate matters and giving people the opportunity to be heard matters. And I think that's a valid point. But I also think that one of the things that that those of us who represent us in Congress are seeing and feeling every day is the impact that these mass, incredible, illegal, most of them have now been determined, layoffs and not layoffs, they're out and out firings have had in Washington, and the impact that it's having on families, on an entire community that is from one day to the other. Truly, the human toll of this is very real. And a government shutdown would have meant that there was nothing for people to come back to. Mm-hmm. Even though these victories have occurred in court, back pay has been ordered, all of these things, and we know there are going to be appeals, but when you shut the government down, there is nothing to come back to. And I just wonder whether or not that has an impact on some of the decisions that are being made, because we've got folks representing us in Washington who are living this, seeing this. They know people. They know families.
Right.
Everyone knows someone. And I've had some conversations with some folks, and it's truly devastating not to know whether you're going to be able to make your rent payment or your mortgage payment.
Well, I mean, that is the thing of court order. You're let go, and then the court says you can't. But where do you go? And what do you do? And there's no structure. If
you were to be brought back like many were, you know, like the Department of Agriculture had to bring back hundreds of people, they couldn't do their job. And if you were one of those people, would you think that you have longevity in that job or security in that job? Of course not. I mean, the upheaval is just. And then think about all the current federal employees who haven't been let go yet, and how they do their job every single day, and instead of worrying about the job that they do, they're worrying about their job, and that just interferes and reduces the ability to do your job well.
And I think when you take these jobs, people have choices, and there are certain, whether you like them or not, civil service protections that attach to these jobs that people rely on when they're making these types of decisions. And so I think that's the other piece of this that is just from the standpoint of the literal losing your home, not being able to know whether you're going to be able to make your car payment, put food on the table. You know, not all of these individuals are super high paid folks. Mm. These are many, many, many of them living paycheck to paycheck and oftentimes earning less than maybe they could earn in the private sector, but because of the civil service protections that they believe that they had.
Allow me a mini tangent, but I would like to ask the two journalists on the panel and the mayor if she wishes. And that is, 1,000 people lose their job. We're told 1,000 people from the IRS lose mm-hmm. their job. So from where? What impact does that have on the department? What percentage of workers is that? And where are they centered? And how does that impact the average citizen of this country in how we use the IRS or any said department? And my sense of it is that we don't know, right? And that it's just all very chaotic. But I notice that we have a lot about the numbers, but there isn't a lot of contextual information that comes with it.
I've read pieces that do analyze that IRS cuts, talking about how it will delay processing, it'll delay hearings, it'll diminish the ability of the IRS to do audits, and it will delay enforcement of regulations, and that will benefit people who have more complex, wealthy people who have more complex tax returns to file. And I mean, you know, I think those stories are out there. I think there's one of the difficulties is that They're becoming more secret. DOGE is becoming more secret. They're not adhering to the freedom of information laws.
You look at the wall of receipts.
You can only do so much with the information you have, and you can point it out. You can speculate. You can talk to experts, but I think they see regular, legitimate, mainstream journalism as the enemy. It's the enemy of the people. It was identified by Trump years ago, and they're doing everything to throw, you know, basically sand into the gas tank when it comes to the way the media works. And it is effective. It's more difficult, and there's fewer members of the media pursuing it.
Yeah, and the more complex it gets, the harder it is to make those. The more complex the operation. So the nuclear research facility at Los Alamos, I think it is, where these weren't janitors who were let go. These were these were people who were doing research on the next generation of nuclear weapons, on
the handling of the current weapons. Yep. You know, they have to be maintained and weaponized, I guess. And they needed to hire people. They were understaffed. Yep. And now they've been gutted.
And even if you are a real, you know, you want to be real hardcore. And you know, I always think I always imagine these conversations happening in bars, you know, where some guy just, you know, holds up his beer and goes, well, nobody's entitled to a job. Well, what do you do when you let some of the experts who know the nation's nuclear secrets just throw them out the door unceremoniously? I don't think a person easily turns on their country, but what do you do when you have a mortgage to pay and you have college, you know, your kids are in college and you had all these promises that your country made to you, and your country, some guy who gets on stage with a chainsaw and makes a spectacle of himself is the guy who fired you. And then along comes a guy from Russia and says, we will pay you very well. You know, there's the human dimension that you point out, Mayor, and then there's also the national security. You know, they gutted the CIA. I thought it was a bunch of interns initially, and apparently it was more than that. Right. And so, Joe, your question's right on point. How do we decipher all this and put it into context? I don't know in some cases how serious it all is, but I know that some of it is damn serious.
Well, and I think, you know, again, not to pile onto that, but you think about FBI agents who were actively investigating people. We have had a mostly strong success rate in preventing terrorist attacks in our country, and yet we've gutted the agencies that mm-hmm. were working those cases, that were embedded, that were gathering the intelligence. And so I think that I have heightened public safety concerns, then down to the, you know, how are we going to process Section 8 vouchers? How are we going to, as long as we have Section 8, right, which we still have for right now, you know, the brass tacks of how government works. And when you know, we haven't had a conversation with folks in our HUD office in Buffalo since Trump took office. It's not really clear how many of them are still working.
No, I lost my train of thought. Sorry.
All right. You can come back to it if you think of it. 5 minutes left, so we'll take holding pattern for 500, Ken. And that is North Country Republican U.S. Representative Elise Stefanik testifying. Was expected to be the ambassador to the United Nations. She was one of the first cabinet appointments made by the then president-elect Trump in the days following his victory in November. Now, everyone has been confirmed, except for U.S. Representative Elise Stefanik, who remains the only cabinet-level appointment of Donald Trump, who is still awaiting a Senate confirmation after Lori Chavez de Remer was sworn in as Labor Secretary last week. So she is the last woman standing. Stefanik's confirmation as ambassador to the UN has been stalled for months by congressional Republican leaders who have wanted to maintain their slim majority in the House of Representatives. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson suggested last month that Stefanik's vote on Republicans' budget resolution could clear the way for her confirmation, but that is still pending. The North Country Republican is likely to stay put in the 21st Congressional District pending the outcome of two congressional special elections in Florida, both scheduled for April 1st. New York law holds that Kathy Hochul, the governor, would then have 10 days to schedule a special election within the next 3 months, putting the race on track for a summer election.
Which will be low turnout.
I'll jump on that in a moment. I remembered what it was.
And oh, okay, great.
Just talking about the expertise that's leaving the government, or you know, and what the context of all these things is, you know, when I was thinking of it when I was reading the story about the battle Trump is having in court over immigration, over deportation, and you see titles like Deputy Attorney General so and so commented, and I had to wonder at how badly handled this case was and how flimsy the arguments were. You know, the person has a very high-sounding title, but we don't know if that person is 2 weeks on the job, fresh out of law school, you know, someone who, you know, the Heritage Foundation picked up the phone and said, hey, this kid would make a good attorney general or deputy attorney general. That's the other thing that, you know, we just don't know. But on Stefanik.
Yes.
It is. We were talking about this on the break, that it is ironic that Hochul was being attacked over the idea that she might hold up this election strategically for political reasons and the balance of power in the House and so forth. And that's exactly what is happening, what the Republicans are doing with Stefanik and what Trump is doing with Stefanik, is holding up her appointment as a UN ambassador. Ultimately, I would say it's not fair to the people of the North Country. She has gone into absolute, as far as I can tell, silent mode when it comes to doing her job. I haven't looked on her website lately. I did some weeks after her nomination. It hadn't been updated in months as soon as it became clear to her that she was going to have a change of job. She's in ambassador mode, I think, but ambassador in waiting. I don't know how long they're going to hold this out. It'll probably be the Florida elections that'll determine whether Elise Stefanik becomes an ambassador or stays as a representative.
Hmm. Anyone? Mike?
No. It just delays the resolution of who's going to represent the North Country. It's a huge area that de facto isn't getting represented right now, as she is sort of bowed out and getting ready for her next job. The Democrats, party chair people pick the candidates in these special elections, and they picked a farmer, Blake Genderman, he can't even focus on who his Republican opponent is because there's so many still fighting about it. You know, there's all these different people who are kind of fighting at each other and trying to get it, and that can't even unfold. It just seems like it's a bottleneck.
Well, and sadly, in the last few weeks, two Democratic representatives have died in office.
Right.
So the margin has gotten a little bit wider. I don't know if that will create a window, but it's got to be incredibly frustrating. And, you know, this looming thought that it might never even happen is got to be. It'll be interesting to see whether we get another nomination here.
By the way, Jay, we're out of time, but I just wanted to say that looking at the Elise Stefanik webpage, the last The last posting was November 4th.
Wow. There we
yeah,
are.
There you go. There
I was just going to say that if anyone in the room has experience running against no one, it's a Democratic mayor in Albany, you wouldn't be quiet about it. You would be out there doing a vision instead of worrying about who you were going to run against, I would think.
Well, yeah. I mean, you mean as far as the Republicans getting their act together and figuring
yeah,
out who's
going to run? Why should he wait around for them? Why not go all over the district every day?
In fairness, I think yeah. he—
He is doing some of that.
I'm only saying that as I am in the district and I have a lot of postcards from it.
Oh, good.
So,
I think the Democrat is running. I'm not sure who the Republican is.
Right.
And that's the piece.
It shouldn't hamper him.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah.
In fact, it may be an advantage that he can do that.
We're out of time. We end with great energy, but that'll bring us all back tomorrow, and we'll we won't as a group. The panel will be back tomorrow, and we'll talk more.